So every year, this time of year, I give this my regular preparing for Pesach shiur. And after a while, after saying it so many years, I'm doing something else. So last year, over each surah, I would say, were some of the interesting halachic shalos which came up that day or that, shortly beforehand, that I was asked and how I passed on them. And my son did me a favor after Yom Tov, and he wrote them all down.
You remember them?
He remembered them. He wrote them all down after Yom Tov.
Oh.
So he gave me this sheet of paper with the questions without the answers. He said, "Ta, figure out the answers. You can do it." So hence, I said, "Okay, that sounds like an interesting idea." So let's some of the different questions which came up and some of the halacha lemaisa. So I got a question like this. This is somebody ordered a catered Seder night meal, and it's delivered at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Erev the Seder, and it's roast chicken. Our minhag is not to use roast chicken for the Seder. We don't serve anything which is roasted for the Seder. Not just meat, but even chicken. So what's the definition of being roasted? So one definition of being roasted is clearly, if it's roasted over the fire, even if it's roasted, it's pot roast. Even pot roast is considered roasted.
I was going to say, how many of us are sitting here with our fire and spit?
With that, with it?
The fire end.
Right, we're not.
We're not roasting our lamb.
Right. So, but even pot roast is considered roasted for this purpose. So the person called me up, what do I do? So, could they change their, could they switch something they had for Yom Tov day to Yom Tov night, etc.? So the halacha is, if you would take the chicken, put some type of a sauce on it, stick it into a pot and cook it with it, so we absorb the flavor of the sauce, that removes the issue of roasted. So that was the solution which we came up with, the last minute solution which we came up with at that point in time, yes?
So that makes it baked now, as opposed to roasted?
Baked and roasted are the same for our purposes.
All right, so we can't put it in the oven at all?
In the oven, you put it in the oven with a large amount of liquid, that's not called baked, it's called cooked. It's cooked inside the oven.
Cooked.
Right. The point is, it has to be cooked as opposed to a baked or roasted purpose.
So there has to be, the liquid has to be there.
Right. So there has to be enough liquid there that would make a difference in the flavor.
Okay.
So, they just put a little liquid in, they shouldn't stick to the pan. That still would have the issue of being roasted. I got a call, it's Erev Yom Tov, and I got a call, a woman decided to take care of the bugs in the romaine by soaking it in salt water. So then she called me up and asked me, does that work to remove the bugs? Because they know that if you soak it in a soapy solution, the way soap works is it actually makes the connection which the bugs have with the lettuce, it causes them to let go. And therefore, it's easier to then wash it off under running water and remove the and feel that you remove the bugs, and you can check for it more easily. Salt does not do that. So, but that wasn't her least of her problems. So she'll do it now. The problem is that we pass in that mortar, which is kavush, is not kosher for mortar. So what's kavush? So kavush is a person would soak the vegetable in water for 24 hours. That's considered kavush. If it's soaked, so if you wash off all of your romaine and you stick it into the bags, and there's a lot of water left in the bags, it's not necessarily a smart idea because you might have the problem of kavush. It's being soaked in water. But that's only 24 hours, and she didn't know that. But the problem is salt. For salt, or for if a person would recover something in salt or in vinegar, the shear is the time it takes, length of time that it gets it in the kavush is the time it takes to put something on the pot and it should boil, which is about 18 minutes. Assume that the halacha is 18 minutes. So if it sits in salt water for 18 minutes, it's now kavush and it's no longer kosher for mortar. So her shiloh was about the bugs. They said, ma'am, we can deal with the bug problem, but your mortar is not kosher. So that was quite a challenge because there was also like, now you're going to start all over again with get new mortar and start all over again. I didn't have a solution for that one.
So, Rabbi?
Yeah.
So then if you're using vinegar for your romaine, as long as you don't leave it in the vinegar more than 18 minutes, you're okay?
Well, I wouldn't suggest using vinegar for romaine in general. We eat the more, you're not supposed to put vinegar on it. But you know, the mitzvah is to eat it straight. But if a person would do that, it would not passel it. It would not make it unkosher.
No, I meant like you were checking it for bugs, because the way I learned to do it was to rinse it in vinegar and then check for bugs. Is that correct?
I'm not familiar with that. She told me she got the idea from that idea. She said, "Well, salt water will be the same thing as vinegar." I never heard of either of them. Okay, so my understanding is that to use water which has some soap in it.
Okay.
And then because it breaks the connection that the bugs have with the leaf, and that's why you can then you rinse it off after you let it sit in water for soap for a little bit, rinse it off, and then you check it.
So, Rabbi Rangel, how does one go about, when you say soaked for 24 hours, can you just take us through, you're checking all your Arav Yom Tov, how do you go about making it so that it's not soaking for 24 hours? How dry is dry?
It doesn't have to be bone dry. If you're not getting a collection of water in the bottom of the bag, right, so then you're not worried about, that's not, because it wouldn't be a problem.
If I put it through a salad spinner a couple times, it's...
You don't have to do a couple times even.
Not even a couple times.
Yeah. Okay. A common issue which comes up, and this is relevant for this year, is that since the Seder is Friday night, so there are some differences between the Seder Friday night and the Seder during the week. One of them is making salt water. So you can't make salt water. You can't make strong salt water on Shabbos. So if a person forgot to make the Salzwasser for the Seder, so it's Friday night, the person would have to make it. He would have to make it in a weak solution. It would be much more majority of water and much less salt. So that'd be the one thing. Second thing, which also could come up this year, is charoses. So you mash your charoses, you grate your charoses. You also have to mix it with wine. So mixing with wine and halacha touches on the halacha of lisha. That's you're combining a liquid and a salad together and making a mass out of it. So lisha is a halacha which you can say on Yom Tov. That's mutter. You can make a dough on Yom Tov, right? But you can't do that on Shabbos. So a person should be careful to add the wine, preferably before Shabbos. Add the wine into the charoses beforehand. Yep. Once you've added wine, you can add more wine.
Oh. So how much wine do you add before Shabbos? Like a drop, or it has to be a significant amount?
Could be somewhere in the middle.
I have a real recipe.
No, I'm allergic to all of them. I'm allergic to nuts.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I'm allergic to all of them.
They do a smart even.
Yeah, we'll do the dates.
Right, so the point is it should be enough that there's a mass already. It's massing together.
This is going back to the salt water. How strong is salt water supposed to be?
In general, but not in this situation.
Yeah.
You're right. Right. There's, as far as I know, there's no formula given how strong it has to be.
There's like no ratio.
It does say in halacha that when it comes to Shabbos, what's usur, it gives you a ratio, right? Uh-huh. What's usur? If you do it, if it's less than 1/3 salt, 2/3 water, that's mutter on Shabbos.
Less than 1/3 salt.
So.
Oh.
Okay.
But in other words, you're saying make it in advance.
You make it in advance, you do whatever you want.
Make it.
If you didn't make it in advance, your recipe would be less than 1/3.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I got these two questions, which came up in Erev Pesach questions. Both of them were the flip sides. So if somebody's a Bechor. Now the halacha is by Bechor. The halacha is that a Bechor fast if... If the father's not a Bechor and he has a son who's a Bechor, the father fasts for the child till the child is 13. If the father's a Bechor and he has a son who's a Bechor, the mother fasts till the boy is 13.
I never heard that.
Okay. So now, but if the son and the father go to a Siyum, then the mother doesn't have to fast. So what's called going to the Siyum? So there's two questions which came up. One person came up and said, I was by the Siyum, but I ran out before they ate, and I didn't eat any food.
Oh, no.
Right? And one other question, person, I walked in, I missed the Siyum, but I came in time for the food. So what's the main thing? So the colloquial wisdom is the main thing is hearing the siyum. Actually, that's incorrect. The main thing is actually being there for the food. The idea behind it is once a person has been by a sudas mitzvah and he eats from the sudas mitzvah, so you're not, even the person is a bechor, it's proper he should partake of a sudas mitzvah. And once he's eaten by a sudas mitzvah, no reason to fast anymore because you're ready, you ate. But if he missed the sudas mitzvah, he left right before eating anything. I heard the siyum and I ran out and went to work. And now 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I want to eat something. Well, I'm sorry, it's too late. So that situation, I told the person that... now, there is one opinion which is makel on it. But it's the way... If you go through the halacha, it seems very clear that the ikur definition of the siyum is not the actual siyum. It's the meal which comes with it. So the example which I gave them on halacha was a fascinating case. There's a tshuva saver called the Chavos Yara was in his generation, goes back about 350 years ago. He was considered one of the big Dalei Ador in Psak. So the Chavos Yara had the following shaila, that a person made a neder that he's only going to eat by a Sudas Mitzvah. Then he said, okay, what's a Sudas Mitzvah? And he sent the shaila to the Chavos Yara, please tell me what a Sudas Mitzvah is. And that's an interesting way of doing it, you know, making the neder and then asking the question, but that's what he did. So the tshuva of the Chavos Yara is one of the, it's for us, it's probably one of the most basic tshuvas about the definition of a Sudas Mitzvah is this tshuva. Because he goes to all the different possibilities of what a Sudas Mitzvah is. He talks about, obviously, a Sudah of a Pidyon HaBen, a Sudah of the Mila. He says a Sudah of a Siyum is called a Sudas Mitzvah because you're celebrating the fact that you completed something. So that's a Sudas Mitzvah. So let's say you're so excited that you decide to make another meal the next day in honor of the fact that you finished that Sefer. It's also a Sudas Mitzvah. You didn't finish the Sefer that, you finished the Sefer yesterday. But you're celebrating today another meal about the fact that you finished yesterday. It's called a Sudas Mitzvah. It says, and the same thing another day. He says up to 3 days he would consider a Sudas Mitzvah. So it's very clear that the main point wasn't the Siyum, because the Siyum took place 2 days ago. The main point was the meal. The meal is being done as a celebration of the completion. That makes it a Sudas Mitzvah. It's also relevant in these situations where they have this Psak in camp. They have to make a siyum during the 9 days, and they start fleshing. Right. So it's always inevitably always one kid who misses the siyum. Like, he comes in, Rebbe, I missed the siyum. Am I allowed to eat fleshings? And the answer is yes, because the main thing is the sudas mitzvah of. But then the kid says, I was about to see him, but I left and I went back to my bunk, and I want to eat the fleshings over there. The answer is no. You're not partaking part of the sudas mitzvah, so it's, which is the opposite of the way people think. They think, "Well, I was by the ziyum, you know, I missed the ziyum." So that's interesting question which came up. I got a question, both of those. So one of them, I was makel, tell the fellow that came a time for the food, he's okay, and I'll tell the other person he missed the meal and he should be mekayim the yin of actually fasting. Tanis
b'chorim. For Tanis b'chorim, do you have to be by a sudas mitzvah or you have to be by a ziyum? Because if there's a bris, it's any
sudas mitzvah. Any sudas mitzvah. So if you have a bris, like in this last Erev Pesach, there was a bris in White Oak. So a lot of people ordered a lot of extra food because there's a lot of people who came for the sudas mitzvah to chaper rein. I got a phone call Erev Shabbos. This was late in the day, so that they were at a hotel, Pesach hotel, and they set up the neiris for the women around the corner from the dining room.
The dining room.
There's a lot of people in the dining room, and they didn't want to put the table with all these neiris there, so they put it around the hallway, down the hallway. So I said, can you speak to the mashgiach and change that? So they actually tried. The mashgiach, they were not listening to the mashgiach. I said, as far as I'm concerned, you should not make a bracha in that situation. That's not halakha's neiris. The halakha's neiris has to be in conjunction with that in some way it's enhancing the meal. So you say you have it in the dining room where you can actually see the neiros. There's a neiros there. We say it's enhancing the meal. It's nice to have, you know, the lights. It adds a little bit of ambiance, etc. Once upon a time, it was very easy because the lights were what you ate by. The candles is what you ate by. So that was clearly, it was in some way enhancing the meal. Nowadays, we have electric lights. So it becomes much more questionable. What exactly are we doing? The answer is we're adding an ambiance. But down the hallway, you can't see them during the meal. There's no ambiance. That being said, it is important. The halacha actually says that halacha's neiros, besides the halacha, besides the fact you have to have lights where you're eating, a person has to have lights where they're sleeping. Because Al said that if you be in a place where you can't see where you're going to sleep, etc., you know, so a person could hurt themselves, you know, stub their toe on something, trip on something, and then they'll get upset at somebody, and then that's going to, it's going to affect the shalom bias, right? Why did you leave that? You know, that type of, that type of response. So,
excuse me, Rabbi. So yeah. you're saying that, like on Shabbos, it's important in the bedroom that there be some light?
It's important there be light in a way which can come. It doesn't have to be in the bedroom. It has to be in the hallway. It has to be in some way that there's light which can come into the room that a person will be able to see what they're doing in the rooms also. So that comes up a situation. Let's say, you know, a person is, they're going for a simcha and they're eating, everybody's eating together in some shul's dining room or some hall, and they're sleeping in people's houses. So there's a chiyuv to make sure that there are lights in the houses. Mm-hmm. And if you go with straight halacha, it might be even better to actually make a bracha in the house where you're staying, that make a bracha by the meal, because the Shulchan Aruch holds the only one woman will make a bracha when there's multiple women lighting, because you made a bracha on this neiris. The Rambam says Aruch because all the women, each woman makes, but each person sleeping separate, you would definitely make, you can make a bracha in the case where there's no halacha on the achila, there'd be a halacha on the shina. That being said, you're not going to leave candles lit in somebody's house and walk out and leave them there. So can you make a bracha on electric lights? So you can't make a, you can definitely cannot make a bracha on a fluorescent or on an LED. You cannot make a bracha on that. The question is, can you make a bracha on an incandescent light? Rimersha holds yes. The Ikar Pesach is not. The most poskim will say tell you not to do that.
Rabbi?
Yes.
What's the difference in the lights?
The difference in the lights. Okay. So an incandescent light, and the way it works is that the filament, get the electricity goes through the filament and the resistance causes it to glow red, become hot to the point that it glows.
So it's like fire.
So that has a halacha like fire, because there's something which is actually, you're generating heat and light from it. So it has a halacha like fire. The way a fluorescent bulb works is that the electricity goes through and it excites the electrons. The electrons affect the impact with the phosphorus coating, which its nature is when its electrons are excited, it gives off light, but there's no heat involved in it. The heat that you'll feel in a fluorescent is actually not from the bulb itself, for the most part, usually is because the process of getting your electron, that whole process going, there's a ballast or something inside, which that functions more like an incandescent bulb. There's heat being generated over there, but the bulb itself doesn't work like that. So most persons say that's not considered ish.
So, like in a hospital where I'm familiar with, and people are using Shabbos lights in there because they can't.
Right, so they're using electric lights.
You have to be careful that they were incandescents.
Correct, they should be incandescents.
Thank you. Stock up.
And then, stock up. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, the and the LEDs for sure. That's it. You know, LEDs even more. It's even less a concept of the way an LED works. Is if you remember your basic science, so there are shells where the electrons go around the nucleus of the atom, and there are layers of shells. They're called subshells. There's layers which, so if you put an electric current through into it, the more energy it has, the closer it goes into the nucleus. When you stop that for a second, so the electrons bounce back out to a further shell. The energy which is released from that process of moving from the inner shell, which is what moved them to the outer shell, which the energy is released, certain diodes will release that as light emitting diodes. That's what it is. So it's nothing. It's electrons releasing the energy. There's nothing at all which is burning. It's air. So it's not considered ash. So it's really improper that with this type of hotel they should be having people not lighting the dining room. It's very improper. You know, that's why I said the mashgiach should try to take care of it. Of course, when the question comes up, erev Yom Tov, till you get the right, you know, you're in a rush to get everything done, it's very hard to get things done at that point in time.
Rabbi, one other question about that.
Yeah.
Would you be able to like get up and walk into the hallway and eat a little bit and then come back and have that count because you got some ambience in the moment or two you were standing there?
I would, if
in a situation where
I would say it's proper to like, but I would not make a broke.
Okay.
Right. Okay. A lot of different questions will come up. I want to move to something else. Just because I want to make sure I remember to get to it. Erev Tavshilin. So this year, Pesach falls out. The Shvi'ishal Pesach falls out on Erev Shabbos. So you have to make an Erev Tavshilin to be able to allow you to cook from Shvi'ishal Pesach for Shabbos, which for us will be the last day of Pesach in Eretz Yisrael. It's a Pesach weekday, or not weekday, it's a Pesach Shabbos, even though it's not Pesach anymore. You're going to be cooking from Shvi to Shabbos. So it's a very important issue, first of all, that we have to understand the Erev Tavshilin. Erev Tavshilin is not magic. If the Torah will not allow you to cook from Yom Tov to Shabbos, Erev Tavshilin can't change that. So you have to assume that you were allowed that what, the Erev Tavshilin, Miraraisa, you're allowed to cook from Yom Tov to Shabbos. The Chum said not to. They said, if you make an Erev Tavshilin, we're going to allow you to. So Erev Tavshilin only kicks in once we've taken care of the prohibition on the Torah level of cooking from Yom Tov to Shabbos. Then the Erev Tavshilin says that even though really Miraraisa, you're allowed to cook, the rabbi said no, unless you make an Erev Tavshilin. That's how it works. But how do you? What's that? This is this permission to cook from Yom Tov to Shabbos. What's that about? So there are two opinions in the Gemara. One opinion says that you're allowed to cook from Yom Tov to Shabbos. That the Torah allows you to cook from Yom Tov to Shabbos. That's very easy. The second opinion says no, you're not allowed to cook from Yom Tov to Shabbos. A person would cook from Yom Tov to Shabbos, he was mechalel Yom Tov. You're only allowed to cook in Yom Tov for Yom Tov. So how in the world do we cook from Yom Tov to Shabbos? So the answer is because theoretically, the food that you're making, it could be used for Yom Tov. How so? If guests would come in and need something to feed them, you could feed them that food. Therefore, the Mishabur points out that this is not a halachic fiction, it has to be a reality. So if I want to say I'm going to come Friday morning and put up a cholent for Shabbos, so I put up a cholent Friday morning, theoretically, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when guests come by, I have this nice cholent, I've been sitting and cooking for 8 hours, a nice, very tasty cholent, I can serve my guests some cholents. Let's say, however, I decide, oy vey, it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon, shki is at 7 o'clock, and I forgot to put up the cholent. That's wonderful. I put the cholent now, it's not going to be edible on Yom Tov, especially not for guests. So according to this opinion in the Gemara, it'd be an issur d'oraisa to cook that. Now how do we paskin? So Mishabur says we paskin like that opinion. That you're not allowed to cook from Yom Tov to Shabbos. You're only allowed to cook because theoretically it's usable for Yom Tov. And therefore practically it has to be actually available to use for Yom Tov if necessary. So in a situation where a person woke up late in the day and wants to cook from Yom Tov to Shabbos, and it's not going to be ready for Yom Tov, so what do you do? So he says like this, in a case where you're dealing with Yom Tov to Rabbanon, the second day of Yom Tov, there are some Rishonim Paskin like the other opinion. So we'll be soimich on that in that situation. But a case where it's a Yom Tov to Raisa, says, I can't tell you that. So this year we're talking about Shvi'ishal Pesach, which is a Yom Tov to Raisa. Person has to be very, very careful to make sure that any food they're going to be cooking on Yom Tov for Shabbos has to be cooked in such a way that it's going to be usable on Yom Tov. It has to be put up early in the day. So that's an issue which every time it comes up, I speak about it. Every time I always say, "Oh, I forgot." It's a real issue. So Mishabur says, in case a person forgot, he will not be lenient to allow a person to cook the food in that situation. That being said, this issue never comes up. Rosh Hashanah, Sukkot, simplest Torah, all can come out on Erev Shabbos. It's always the second day. The only time you're going to have a Yom Tov D'oraisa situation is the last day of Pesach and Shavuos. Last day of Pesach and Shavuos.
No, I was thinking about
Rosh Hashanah or Sukkot on Friday Shabbos.
Right, it's just a Thursday, Friday Shabbos.
It would be Sunday.
Right.
The second day of Rosh Hashanah can be Erev Shabbos. Right?
Correct.
Yeah. Right, I was thinking, but that's Yom Tov Sheni.
That's still Yom Tov Sheni. It's still the Rabbanon.
Even
right.
Though
it's a more common right, Rabbanon, it's still the Rabbanon. Right. Shavuos can fall out on Erev Shabbos. Shavuos can be Friday Shabbos. And Shvi'ishal Pesach can fall out on Erev Shabbos. So those are the two where it's a relevant problem. Let's say first I forgot to make an Erev Tavshilin. So I saw this idea in the Gudah. in Baltimore, which I thought is a very nice idea. Saw this a few years ago. I was there for Yom Tov. It was in the case of the Neir Tov Shilin. After Mincha, there was an announcement that up in the kitchen there are matzahs and there are eggs. Anybody who forgot the Neir Tov Shilin, you can please go take a matzah, take an egg, and make an Neir Tov Shilin. So and a few people, ran out. Went up to the So I said, it's not a bad idea. So last year we had an Erev Tov Shilin situation. Sukkot was Thursday, Friday, Shabbos. So both the first day of Sukkot and last day of Sukkot, I did that. And both times I had somebody. I made an announcement, by the way. And both times somebody took me up on the offer. I said, so I point out it's now theirs, and they should take it home. This is part of their Shabbos meal. They should take it home. Now, theoretically, a person can make an Erev Tov Shilin long distance. So a person who's now here in Shul realizes they did not make an Erev Tov Shilin, they can say, back at home I have a roll and I have a piece of meat. I'm being miyachad that roll and a piece of meat for the purpose of Erev Tov Shilin, and make the Erev Tov Shilin. It doesn't have to be in front of you. It's not obviously preferred that it should be in front of you, but that situation, really, they could have done it at home. Of course, you have to make sure that nobody, meanwhile, is eating that item back at home, because then you lose. Then you're in trouble. That piece of meat. Yeah, I gave it to the baby to eat. Thank you very much. Right. So you would have to be careful with that problem. Can you be samech on the Rav? So the law is you can be samech on the Rav one time. So the Rav makes an Erev Tov Shilin. He's a mezaka to be for this everybody in the city, and the law is you can rely on that one time. If a person then forgets a second time, they're considered a pesheya, and they're not allowed to rely on the Erev of the Rav. The Erev Tov Shilin of the Rav. So that is a discussion in halacha.
Like an out of pocket max? Like, what is this?
Right. So it's a lifetime cap or not? Is it a lifetime cap or not? So that's actually machlokes. And there are definitely a person would say that if a person gets back into good behavior and is careful, and then they forget, we don't say it's considered a continuation of their attitude. So in the case of Biryabed, you'd be samech on that. But there are usually other rates for that. Okay. Some Seder questions. Person wants to mix wine together. So we know it's preferred that the wine should be colored red, zecher to the nisim. I like white wine better. So I want to, so I'll put a little grape juice into my wine, and that now my wine will be red, right? So here's a question. So the lacha, one of the lama test malachas is suveya, which is coloring. So we know that the coloring doesn't apply to oichel. There's no issue of coloring when it comes to oichel. There's no din of tzeveya when it comes to oichel. However, the post can raise the following point. So let's say, he said, that's all if my main focus is mixing the foods together, and it happens to be that the color is produced. So I like mixing in some cumin into my food, and it colors my food yellow. But my goal isn't the yellow color. My goal is the taste. So that's not a problem with tzeveya. However, in a case where my goal is the color, so the Debra Tzina has the following question. So you remember that you have like these, they have for the bathroom, for the toilet, they have these water fresheners which color the water blue. Are you allowed to use them on Shabbos and Yom Tov? Well, it says, there's no tzviya when it comes to oichel. It says, but over here, my point over here isn't oichel. My point over here is I like the color. I want it to look nice and fresh and clean. My goal isn't that, since he feels in that situation, it would be also to do that. So taking that logic and applying it over here, so I suppose I'm going to raise the question. So what you do is you pour your white into the red. You don't pour the red into the white, because then you don't see a process of coloring taking place. If you have white there, you pour the red in, it's coloring it. If you have red and you pour white in, you don't see any coloring taking place, and that's mutter. Person shows up, person has guests which are not Shomer Shabbos, a very common problem. Or a person has guests which are not Jewish. Sometimes you have, people are Shuba, and they have, the family Seder, and the family, there's somebody that halachically is not really Jewish, and they're going to be showing up at the Seder, or showing up for a Yom Tov meal. So the law is you may not cook for a non-Jew on Yom Tov. Number one. And that cooking for a non-Jew on Yom Tov is an issur d'oraisa. It's the same thing as cooking on Yom Tov for a weekday. We're not. It's not. It's not good. The head to the cooking yom tov applies to, for Jews. Step number one. Step number two. A person who makabel Shabbos has a status like a non-Jew. And according to the way the Mishnah Berurah understands it, that's an issue of the rice to cook for a makabel Shabbos Jew on yom tov.
Who said that?
Mishnah Berurah. Okay. Now, why? Because the makabel Shabbos gets the status of a non-Jew. What about our people nowadays? Which are, what's their status? They're Mechal Shabbos. They don't know better. This Tinish and Ishba concept, you know, they didn't really know better. The Mechal Shabbos, which Allah was talking about, a person who knowingly decides in to publicly, even though there's people there, he doesn't care, and he's Mechal Shabbos, and he's making a statement, I don't care to be part of the Jewish nation and keep Shabbos. So that's clearly, he has to be like a non-Jew. Karim Shabbos, and he said the rice of the Kuf Kareem and Yom Tov. What's the status of a person who doesn't know better? So this is a machlokes in a Rambam and a Ramban. This question came up. The Karoyim were Jewish people who were not keeping halacha. They had their own version of the halacha, and they decided to not keep the halacha. So the Rambam says that the first generation Karoyim have a din of like a non-Jew. They're Mechalei Shabbos. He says their children grow up not knowing any better. They don't know any, but they think that this is what you're supposed to do. So they don't have that status, the Rambam says. They don't have a status of being like a non-Jew because they don't know any better, and therefore they're considered Jews for making a mistake. So they would not have this halacha. The Ramban argues. The Ramban says that once in their life, they've had an opportunity to meet a true rabbinic Jew who keeps the halacha properly, and they choose not to learn from them. Whether they think there's different streams of Judaism, different divisions of Judaism, I don't care why. That's a decision that they made. They're no longer considered a tinuk shenishba, and they have a halacha like a non-Jew. How do we paskin? Not clear how we paskin. There's been no definitive to psak on this issue. So that comes very question why you're allowed to cook for a non Shomer Shabbos Jew on Yom Tov. Step number one. Step number two, Chazal came along and said, talking about an actual non-Jew, let's go back to actual non-Jew. Chazal said, you know, you can't cook for a non-Jew on Yom Tov, and it's an issue of the rice to cook for a non-Jew on Yom Tov. So it's not a great idea to have this guy by your meal because you might cook for him. So there's an issue of the Rabbanon to invite a non-Jew for a meal on Yom Tov. You're allowed to invite a non-Jew for a meal on Shabbos, but not on Yom Tov. Because on Shabbos, you're not going to cook anyway. So this year, the first Seder is Shabbos, so we don't have any problem. Right? But the second Seder, and the Yom Tov, any time you would have Yom Tov, which is not Shabbos, so there's an Isser Durabonan to invite a non-Jew. So how do you invite the relatives? They're cooking with them. How do you invite them? So there's a prima gadim says like this. First of all, like this. So the first solution is we advise not to do any cooking in that situation. The same way on Shabbos, all the food is cooked beforehand. I'm not cooking anything, so I would want to cook beforehand. This is very relevant when you have a Pesach hotel. So some of the people in the Pesach hotel are not halachically Jewish necessarily. Some of the people in the hotel are not Shomer Shabbos, but they come for a Pesach hotel. So my staff can't be cooking for them on Yom Tov. So the answer is you want to have the food as much as possible, cooked beforehand. Now, that's not very, if you have a very, very fancy hotel, of course, part of the sales pitch is it's freshly cooked, right? So that's wonderful, but that's you get one of your tensions between the mashgiach and the Rav Machshir and the hotel. There's a prima godim who says a leniency, which he says that if there's a concern of Shalom Bayis, of Eva, we can be lenient on the Issa D'Rabbanan. So if you feel that it's going to affect the family negatively by not inviting these people, you can invite them. It takes away the Issa of inviting. It doesn't allow for the cooking part. So now the person says, it says, do me a favor, can you put up, I don't have a percolator up for you. I use my teapot. Says, can you put up a water for a cup of coffee for me? The answer is no. I can't put up a cup.
I'm erasing this whole thing.
I can't cook for them on Yom Tov. So I put up the pot for a non-Jew a pot of water to cook them a cup of coffee on Yom Tov, I did it in a Siddur'isa.
Can I?
Okay, so what's the solution?
I think I know.
What? Yes?
I think I know because I'm a Gyor. So I think the solution is that you cook a whole bunch of food for the Jewish people.
Good.
And then the leftovers can go to the non-Jews.
Right, so there's a rule called Reva B'Shurim. If in one action you're cooking a larger amount for truly for a Jew, not a game, but truly, then there's no issue if you cook for the non-Jew also. So I put up. He said, "Oh, I'll join you in a cup of coffee." And then you have to put enough water in the chatkila for both of you. Mm-hmm. You can't add water after. That doesn't solve the problem. I said, "Okay, you know what? That's a great idea." So you have to be on your toes. Yeah, a cup of coffee, great idea. I think I'll join you. I'll put up water for the two of us. So then you put up water for both of you. Then afterwards, you can make the coffee for both or whatever the situation might be. But that's an issue which you have to be aware of, which has some challenges in it.
So this is the same for a non-firm family.
And this would be the same thing for a non-firm family.
Okay, I'm remembering why we just don't invite them.
Okay. you remember why your husband says we're not going to write the preemptive. That's what the answer is.
No, I'm remembering why. Like this is why we just don't want to deal with that. But
okay.
For people who are in Kirov, how do they do this? Does this include warming up food when you say
cooking? Now? So warming up food is not. So the preemptive says, as I said before, if the food is cooked before and warming is not a problem.
Okay.
Warming basically really is the same thing as Shabbos.
If it's very liquidy, like if it's a soup, I can't warm it up for them. Except that I'm warming it up for everyone else because it's a
right,
soup.
Right,
what are
right,
we doing anyway?
Right, right, right. Right. But if they say they come in the expression, "That soup is great. You mind give me another bowl of that soup?" Oh, nobody else is having soup, just them. You have to be on your toes. You have to be, because...
What I would do is I would try to incorporate things that I thought that my parents would want.
Right.
I would try to incorporate that into the meal so I shouldn't be in the position where they would say, "Would you mind making me..."
Right. Excellent.
What was that?
Well, because when I was married, both my husband and I were both converts, so everybody who was coming to our Seder was like crazy. So we would try to make ahead of time everything that we thought that they might want and incorporate it into the menu so that way nobody would be asking for something special that we couldn't give them and wouldn't be upsetting them by...
We didn't have prepared.
Right, exactly. And they wouldn't be upset that,
"Oh, I asked you to make me this, and you didn't do that."
Right,
exactly. You didn't make me any Knedlach. We made you Knedlach.
Have a Knedlach.
Right. Okay.
One pizza, forget it.
Okay. Question which comes up is a person's having a difficult time swallowing the matzah. So they want to soak the matzah, or they want to drink some water with the matzah. So soaking the matzah... in general, we discourage that. So a person who's an elderly or a person who's ill, there are leniencies which will be possible to do that. Which I'm not going to get involved in the details of that unless it's Nageya. Drinking water with the matzah. A person's eating matzah and they want to take a drink of water into their mouth. That is mutter. I'm saying that with a little bit of hesitation because it's not we prefer not to do it, but it's mutter. So a person really is having a trouble getting the matzah down and they need to take a drink of water, that's mutter.
What about after the matzah? Like that's mid-matzah. I'm saying like that's like in the middle of your shear.
Right.
You're done.
Yeah, it's
gonna
hay.
I've never seen anybody take the water off the table.
No, yeah, but on the other hand, you never see most people taking a drink of water in the middle of the matzah either, right?
That's true.
Okay. I found chametz.
Oh yes,
right. This question always. I found chametz.
A Cheerio.
Yeah. Oh, so it's a Cheerio. It's one thing. I one year. So one year, I did the bedika. We did the cleaning, everything like that. It's the first day Yom Tov, and we take the umbrella stroller out to go to the park with a Lazar. I think it was maybe Chanabrocha. And there's a roll crumpled up, because when you close it up, so there's a bag which I hadn't noticed, because when it's closed, you didn't notice it. There's a bag with a roll in it, a full bona fide roll.
Like in a stroller or something.
Like in the stroller. The umbrella stroller, And I said, okay. I didn't do my medica well this year, So what do you do? So the loch is that, first of all, that the loch is that chametz is muks on Yom Tov. So you can't move it.
What kind of muksa?
It's muksa. It's real muksa.
It's real muksa.
Okay.
You really can't move it.
Right. So for the halacha says that but on the other hand, you're not supposed to leave chametz there because you might come to eat it. So you're supposed to cover it on Yom Tov. You're supposed to cover it over with some type of kli. Now, if you think that talking to the ladies, that I'm going to let you, Rabbi, use my pace of the kli to cover up your role. You got something coming, right? But that's the halacha. You cover it up with the kli.
And the status of the kli?
The kli, it's cold. It's just wash it off with cold water. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
One year, my daughter pulled a whole bunch. We missed a pocket somehow, and she was playing. She pulled her pocket inside out, and out came all these saltines that were crushed, and they went all over the rug. So after I cried and screamed and ran around, and I put towels on top of it all.
Right.
Because I didn't have a klee that was that
large enough, right? Yeah, so that would be correct.
That would be acceptable.
I think that'd be acceptable. Okay. Now, immediately after Yom Tov is over, Chol HaMoed, you have to dress it. So the halacha says you have to burn it. You take it outside, out of your rishus, and you burn it. The question which comes up, a fascinating question which comes up nowadays is, we sell, in the shtar which we sell the chametz to the non-Jew, we say, whatever's in place X, da da da, and then we throw in its clause, and any other chametz I have in my house. Why not? Might as well have that there for good measure. So now, I find this chametz doesn't belong to me, it belongs to this, not the guy that bought it, right? So I'm not allowed to burn his chametz. I'm a ganef if I burn his chametz. Mm-hmm. So now what's supposed to happen? So what do you do? And let's make it more complicated. Okay? So there are some opinions, so you can't burn it. So what do you do with it? So you take it and put it together with the place where you have the chametz you sold to the goy, you should put it there. The problem is, Chazal said, you're not allowed to hold chametz in your hand because you might eat it. So how do you get your chametz outside to burn it? On Chol HaMoed. The answer is, because I'll say the logic, it's not logical that you'll be eating it if you're running outside to burn it. But here I'm not running outside to burn it, I'm going to put it away. So maybe I might come to eat it. So the Chazanish says you would have to actually not move it by hand, you'd have to kick it.
It should be like a shinui.
You'd have to do it with, you can do it with a foot, you can do it with a stick, you don't do it by hand. That being said, many parts come, and I think it's correct that you can burn it. Because even though it belongs to the goy, the understanding by the goy is that, he owns his chametz. He doesn't really mind if you burn it. Because at the end of the day, his main goal over here is that after Pesach, he's going to sell it back and get some money out of the deal. Mm-hmm.
Does he get money out of the deal?
He does, yeah. That's how we do it, yeah.
Rabbi?
He makes some money on the deal.
But when you burn your chametz before Pesach, you say that everything is like null and void. So does the chametz you found, is it really still chametz?
So null and void means, in regards to the prohibition of ownership, it's null and void. But Chazal said we don't want to rely on that for actual chametz because it's null and void. But this is a great donut. Uh-huh. Okay. I actually had a chaver who told me his story, his emergency story that his father almost did, who knows what to him. He loved donuts. He was very upset that they're taking all the donuts. He hid a donut under his pillow. And the first night by the Seder, when his father said, okay, Kindelach, and now the house has no chametz in it, he says, Tati, there is. He says, what do you mean? He runs to his bedroom and he pulls out the donut. He starts running to the table to show his father.
He's telling me this wasn't like a powdered sugar.
So the father, he has this get that thing out of here! running towards the center table with the donut, you're crazy! Suffice it to say that the young man was treated to...
Scarred for life?
What?
Scarred for life.
He was treated to some...
You say if it's calamari, you should burn it?
Yeah. All right, so I'm comfortable saying you should burn it. Yeah, not like that.
Okay, what if you and basically because the guy doesn't care, really.
Right, correct.
Could it be put just inside your barbecue grill that you're not going to open up anyway, just leave it?
You have to burn it. You have to destroy it.
Okay.
So, you know.
So you couldn't just, like, throw it out in the street where it wouldn't belong to anybody.
Correct.
Put it on a train track.
There is an option. You know, you can crush it up and spread it, throw it to the winds. You could crush it up and flush it down the toilet. You could burn it. We prefer an halacha to burn it, but any of those things would be options to do. Okay, so now here's the flip, the second half of this conversation, which I got this again. Every other person says, "Well, I need something from the Chametz cabinet." Or better, it says, "I was like really smart." It says, "I sold the whole room to the goy, and I put all my Chametz in there. I need something from the room." It says, "Excuse me, you sold the room to the goy. You're trespassing." So some shtoris actually have clause that if I need to, I can go into the room. The problem is, the halacha is that there's chometz. If you're selling real chometz and there's chometz in there, the halacha is on Pesach, because I'm afraid you might come to eat chometz. So they don't want to rely on just a covering. You have to have a mechitza in between you and the chometz. It has to have a valid halacha of a mechitza. It has to be 10 tefachim high. It has to can't be waving the wind. It has a bona fide halacha wall. So we can't allow you to go into that room, because once you go into that room, he probably doesn't mind, you know, whatever. Okay, really, okay. So, but then, so you go into the room, you're in a room with chometz, which you're not allowed to be in the room with chometz unless there's some type of partition between you and the chometz. So that's something which people have to be aware of, that there is a requirement of this partition. There is a kula, which I saw recently. It's talking about if you have something which is Varei Chometz, something Chometz Gomer, and so it's Varei Chometz, and it's in a place, you know, which theoretically you might be going, you need a Mechitza. If I'm going to put it somewhere, you know, I have it somewhere in my basement, I have a room off to the side, which I don't go into at all, and I'm not really selling Chometz Gomer anyway, so then you don't need Mechitza. That's good enough, just putting it in the room, even without selling the room. If you sell the whole room, so you have no problem. It's not my room. Mm-hmm. That's the mechitza. There's a door. But you keep, once you walk through that door, you've taken away your mechitza. So I said, I don't have a problem saying that the logic will dictate that we can make an halachic assumption. He doesn't mind if you walk through there. So it's as if he gave you permission. But you have another problem, which is the mechitza problem. You need to have a mechitza there. You need to have some type of a partition between you and the chometz. I said it's really not a great idea to do this, you know, because I got two people, a father and a son, asked me the same question within a half an hour of each other. Like, you know, I said, like, you know, is there any like a habit forming thing going on over here between the, you know, people aware of this. It's not something you can take lightly. When you're selling it, you're selling the room. That being said, when you have chometz gomer, even if you sell the chometz gomer to the goy, you can't have a goy's chometz gomer in your rishus. So that's when we sell the place where it's on also. So we sell the area which is there. So that's why you say, okay, I'll put it away in a certain section. I'm selling the whole area, so I don't have to worry about anything. It's all sold. It's not a problem. Which that's how we do the shtar. We sell the place of it also. So it is better to like put it away off to some area off to the side, you know, so you can truthfully say, I'm selling that section. It could be a cabinet, but if it's just a cabinet in the air, so what are you selling exactly? You know, underneath I'm doing my, you know, Pesach cooking, and on top I have the guys. That's not a good idea. So you want to have like some type of a cabinet off to the side.
Wait, okay, now I have a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
here we go. So like the spice cabinet above my, I don't cook there because the stove's not good. But the cabinet above my sink, I can't just sell. I really should clean out. It's just dishes in there. It's
just dishes, that's not a problem.
It's just dishes in there.
That's not a problem, right? The problem is that you just need some type of a hacker to remind you, don't use those dishes.
Oh, I put tape over.
So, right, so that's the type of problem.
So if you leave all your dishes and you just shut it up with tape and you write
that's fine.
Comments on it, that's okay.
That's fine.
But the actual
flour, sugar, whatever
you're selling to, right, if you're selling, you know, you can have some, you know, let's say, I don't sell chametz gomer, right. But I sell some chametz. So some chametz, most vinegar in America is not chametz. but there is vinegar, which is chametz. So it's vinegar, it's in your ketchup and your mustard and your mayonnaise.
Right.
And
all that stuff is in that cabinet.
You know, it's inside. I put it in a specific cabinet, and that whole thing, top to bottom, belongs to the goyim. It's off to the side, and that's it. I put it down in the basement, and that's it.
So I really have to take it out of my kitchen.
You should.
It's in a cabinet that's closed.
So you should take it out of the kitchen. Yeah, it should be able to say that this mokum belongs to him, not just the cabinet, but the floor that's standing on belongs to him.
But my dishes can stay put.
Dishes can stay put.
Oh, we're not done yet.
Okay.
Okay, when you said a real machitza, you said it can't blow in the wind. So hanging up sheets is not sufficient? If I want to partition off.
Unless you tie them down on the bottom.
What if I just put rocks? Like, just have to. I have no real way to tie them down if I put rocks on them. Would that suffice?
It would be suffice, yeah.
It has to just be.
It has to be really solid and like going on the wind.
What about if you have a freezer? I've seen people who have taken all their bread and put it in a garbage bag and put it in the bottom like part of the freezer. And they're using the rest of the freezer, you know, they're using that, but this is like contained and it's not going to flap in the wind, but it's in the same area. Is that permitted?
Yeah, that was my next question, the freezer.
Clearly labeled. It says
chametz. It's clearly labeled.
Right. Right. I understand. So the clear label. The problem is that you know, but that you have. If it's true chametz.
No, it's true chametz.
True chametz. You have it because all required a mechitza.
Well, if it's in a drawer in the bottom of your freezer, would that qualify as mechitza?
Or if I put it in a box,
right?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
Don't think so.
So we got to really empty the freezer.
Yeah.
Oh my, Rabbi, you just made my yom tov a lot harder.
Well, so the solution is you have two freezers.
But I don't have two freezers.
So you find a neighbor who does and stick it in theirs.
Right.
I'm saying, like, I have a freezer upstairs and a small one.
My understanding, maybe I understood this wrong, but there was a certain idea that, like, if you had 20 pounds of flour, okay, and Pesach is coming, and it's going to cost you, you know, a lot of money to throw it away or give it away, that you could actually, you know, sell it, and it can be put away.
But right, no problem.
And that's not a problem, right? As long as it's in this closet or whatever.
Right.
But it's a problem if it's any place where you're messing around.
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
What if you had a refrigerator freezer, top part is a refrigerator, bottom part is a freezer. That freezer will contain chametz, but it's a separate door. You could put tape on the door.
If
the door is chametz, but you're not using it for anything. You're not going to go in there for ice cubes.
Right. So then you could say that you're selling that whole. You're selling the whole thing. So that the machitza is the door. The door is the machitza.
Right. Okay.
But over here, there's no door because you're opening the door and you're going into the freezer of other things.
Right.
So the problem is having the drawer in the bottom of the freezer or the fridge that you're storing the chametz in during Pesach. That's right. The problem, right? Okay.
Okay.
That was exciting.
you know, you always get at least one cooler from the share and one chumra from the share. That's the deal. What? Which cooler did you get? I allowed you to reconstitute your roasted chicken into
boiled
chicken.
Oh, that's true. I can reconstitute my roasted chicken.
Okay.
It's very exciting. That's my reason. I think a lot of people do that. I think a lot of people do that.
What?
With the freezer.
I know. That's a good point.
Refrigerators as well.
Mm-hmm.
People put things
in the vegetable part.
In the vegetable bin. Oh, shoot.
For sure.
This is always very exciting, Rabbi Reingold.
Okay.
What if you remember on Erev Yom Tov that you want to get something out of your Pesach, out of your chametz cabinet?
Erev Yom Tov is more lenient. Nighttime is when things start getting, when Pesach actually starts, things get more excited. Mm-hmm. It's not a chiyuv koras Erev Pesach. It's only a lav. But once Pesach starts, it's a chiyuv koras.
I guess I won't.
So So, you go to a different section of Gehenna.
Lucky me.
You spoke about closing off a room and selling a whole room in your house. What if you sell your whole house?
You could sell the whole house.
You're not planning to be home.
Right.
But let's say something happened and an important paper was needed from your house.
Right. So that would be this type of question. So you could sell the whole house, and if you sell the whole house and the sale is affected, for example, this is a common question. When we usually make our sale the 14th of Nisan, Erev Pesach, sometime in the early, in the morning. Right. The night you do bedikah the night before. So when the night before, I still own that item, so I have to bedikah on it. Let's say I would sell my house on the 13th. Mm-hmm. So when it comes the night of the 14th, it's not my house anymore. So I'm not chayv in bedikah. So a person would be able. The Mishnah says you shouldn't do it in such a way that you're going to lose your mitzvah bedikah. So the answer is you keep one room for yourself and you buy one room and the rest of the house you sell. Or you can do bedikah where you're going. You're going to.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, so you keep your.
You can do bedikah in the hotel room that you're going to. You can do. You're not going to lose the mitzvah bedikah, right? So I haven't lost the mitzvah bedikah. I've sold the whole house. I'm parted from doing bedikah in the house. I sell it on the 13th, and that's fine. You can do that as long as it's sold beforehand. But now you need something. So theoretically, you could go in because we have to get we have a trespassing issue belongs to the goy, right? So we'll say probably he doesn't mind if I go in, or you're right in some shores they actually write, I have Greece's regal, etc. But you have a machitza issue, if you want to go into the room, I keep my papers. Chances are there's no chometz there, so that's not a machitza issue.
Right.
So, but if I had to go into a place where there's a bare chometz, so I would have an issue. You can't go to the room because you don't have a machitza there. You come and have one second. First, we're going to shoot a machitza in and set it up. Not going in the room. I mean, how do you do that? So it's a problem. That idea of selling and parting from bedikah is an option to do that. I got a shayla that the family has. They have a non-Jewish au pair, which lives there. They're going away for Yom Tov, the non-Jewish woman is staying in the house. So they just basically, so they can't sell out the house because they have somebody staying there. Who's going to be cooking chametz?
Aren't there a lot of shiloh cooks in your house?
So there's many different questions that come up with that, but the one says, like I said, you can sell the house to her. Mm-hmm. I can't, she can't sell to somebody else, but then she has to get permission to stay there. You sell the house to her. So now it's her house, it's her covenants. Now you have to deal with, what are your issues of your meat in your freezer, your wine, your oven, many different issues which we had to go through, work them out. But that was the phone call. That was the phone call for today. That was today.
Oh my.
No, that was yesterday. I'm sorry. That was yesterday.
But you actually could sell the house. You could sell the house to the au pair, because I thought there was all these stringencies about who you were supposed to sell your hametz to.
The main question is not who, but how. The how is complicated. Okay. The how is complicated because exactly what is the correct opinion, how we do it, etc. I'll tell you a cute story. When I was a bucker still, so I remember I realized I had I didn't own anything. I realized I had some medications, different things which might have chometz issues. I realized it Erev Pesach in the morning. I was in Brooklyn, so I called up Rav Hillel David and asked him, "Can I sell my chometz?" He says, "Come over right now. We're selling right now." So I walk into the room, and there was six of the biggest rabbonim in flappers sitting by this table with this guy over here with his big red cap. They're sitting together by the table. And these six rabbanim together probably have shuls, They probably together they have a few $1 million worth of chametz being sold to this guy, And I came in with an audience and I quickly made my kinyan, and my 5 cents of was also being included in the sale. I was saying that guy doesn't realize what he's buying over here. First of all, the fact that he gets to sit with his table with all these rabbis, I would love that, he owns.
Half of
Flatbush's chametz, these whiskeys, and there's the flour, the real stuff, So in Europe, the problem was they had was they would sell the inn. They would sell the whiskey in the inn to the goy. And then if Yehuda's the case, well, the goy says, listen, that's my chum. It's the middle of Pesach. He comes and starts drinking it. Right. You can't stop him. It's his. Now, the way we do it is he doesn't pay the full amount before. He pays a minimal amount. And it says that the rest of the money is due in 9 days. And then after 9 days, he asks, do you want to pay the rest of the money? Or do you want to sell it back? So that's what he does. Well, the goy didn't have money to pay. This guy's the Jewish innkeeper is going to be wiped out. The guy said, he brought all his friends to have a whiskey party. He's not going to pay after Pesach. There's nothing to buy back. He's wiped out. So what do you do? All right. So that was it. You know, so those were the real shilas that they dealt with. You know, how to figure out how to deal with that shilas. Okay.
Can we go back to the cabinet for a minute? How well do you have to clean out your cabinets that you're not using?
It's not any different than cleaning out your bedroom.
My understanding is there can't be obvious hummets. Right. You're not expected to be checking for microscopic hummets.
With my hummets, with my pots and pans, and my cabinets with my pots and pans, I have to be cleaning out?
No, I mean, you would swipe it out. It's like a basic wiping out, and that's it. Now, the pots should be, assuming that all your pots and pans and the dishes are clean.
They're clean.
Yeah.
So. I have to wipe it out, or I could just, like, there's nothing there.
If you see nothing there, there's nothing there. You don't have to wipe it out. As long as
I'm
you
saying,
see
like, I could just look.
Yeah.
I'm closing it up and selling it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that whole thing, like, how
checking,
far...
There are some people who empty out every cabinet.
Yeah.
Clean every pot.
Yeah, okay.
I just wanted to clarify how...
Wash the windows, too.
Yes, right. But I'm not...